The following episode of Footy Prime the Podcast contains violence, coarse language, talking of shite, full frontal nudity, and adult scenes. Listener discretion is advised. BetMGM, the place for soccer in Canada, presents Footy Prime.
Oh, let's go!
Footy, footy, it's time to get this party started. It's the Footy, footy, it's time to get this party started. With Danny, Jimmy, Gregor, Andy, Jimmy, and JC. All we know and all we talk about is Footy, footy. It's time to get this party started tonight.
BetMGM, the place for soccer in Canada, presents Footy Prime. And this...
How does a goalkeeper play over 500 Premier League games, have over 150 clean sheets, and get forgotten by modern football fans? They go straight to the big names, Cech, Schmeichel, Alisson. So how does an Aussie last that long between the sticks in the hardest league in the world without any hype? Same story every season, no fuss, no drama. So how does a keeper that consistent end up being treated like he was just decent? Maybe because he wasn't flashy, no cameras chasing him, no Hollywood moments every week. Just positioning, handling, experience, the boring stuff that actually wins games. And here's what modern football doesn't tell you. Not every keeper needs to be a playmaker. Sometimes you just need someone who stops the fucking ball from going in the net. A proper Barclays era survivor. So tell me, is Schwarzer one of the most underrated keepers the Premier League has ever seen? Or was he just some lucky Aussie who ended up getting a lot of appearances? Comment who you'd like to see next.
yes, he's underrated. Mark Schwarzer. Mark, welcome to Footy Prime, mate.
Thank you for having me. I have actually seen that before. Someone sent it to me. I don't even know if the makers of it sent it to me. Someone sent it to me, and I did see it, and I did have a chuckle. And look, I answer that question, I was very lucky. I was definitely very, very lucky. I think anyone who played professional football is lucky to a degree. Obviously, you make your own luck as well. I'm a big firm believer of that. And it's also quite nice and to see stuff like that when people put things up about that. The only disappointment I have is that they missed a clip. Actually, missed probably two clips. 1993 Socceroos against Canada. That's what they missed. That's the only thing I would say.
Well, that was your debut, right, for Australia off the bench because your keeper had been red carded. I think he fouled Dale Mitchell. On you come against this young willowy figure at the other end, Craig Forrest, and you boys found a way to win.
We did. I mean, we lost the first game in Canada, in Edmonton, my first time to Canada, actually. And I was sitting there, my first time involved with a full national team, sitting there on the bench next to Paul Wade, who actually was the captain of the Socceroos up for a long period of time. And he was actually dropped for that game. That was his very first game as captain of the national team to be dropped. So I was sitting next to him. He was my roommate. And we were counting the Aussie flags in the stands. And there was a decent amount. I think there was about 27,000 fans in the stadium. And there was probably about 10 or 15 Aussie flags. We were quite impressed with the number of Aussies that came out to watch us in Canada. And then all of a sudden, Robbie Sabica gets sent off. And it was like, oh, shit. Right. I'm on. And then the next minute, in a blink of an eye, I'm playing a World Cup qualifier, making my debut away from home in Canada in this hostile environment.
Hostile environment.
Yeah. Well, really not all that hostile.
No, it was for me at that time. And also the magnitude of it. A World Cup qualifier is a World Cup qualifier. And I was like 21 years old. So at that time, it was a big deal. And I'd only been playing in Australia, semi-professional. So it was the biggest game in my career up until that point.
I mean, that is something though, right? I mean, making a debut that way, I can only imagine the nerves. Hey, Craig, yeah, so Craig's short-term memory is awful, but his long-term memory is incredible. Do you remember that? You must do.
Are you kidding? Yeah, I remember it vividly. You remember the weather in Edmonton too was terrible. I mean, the wind was insane. Yes. It was just whistling down one end. It was basically a game of two halves. And Nick Dazovic scored an own goal on a corner and it was whipped in and it just, the wind sort of took it. So he was like, whoa, trying to head it away. And he ended up heading it straight into the top.
Of course it was an own goal, Craig. Of course you would say that.
Right? No. I'll vouch for it. It's true. Very true. Craig had no chance.
The goalkeeper union again. Yeah. Coming to each other's defense.
Yeah. And that World Cup qualifying campaign, I mean, obviously is much different now with all the teams that qualify. Both of us would have qualified by right in 2026, back then, finishing second in CONCACAF gave us this quarter spot where we had to play Australia, and then home and away, we lose on penalties in Sydney. And then Australia, and you guys had to go along and beat or try to beat Argentina and Diego Maradona in a home and away match as well to then qualify. So you can see why Australia moved to the Asian region because of, you know, not having the automatic qualifying spot. And I think that was a big part of it. But you guys, what, 1-0 on aggregate on a fluke deflected goal in Buenos Aires, I want to remember, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, funny enough, just going back to that Canada game is that I was 6 days before that game, I was in Australia coming back from a holiday in Germany. I did a trial in Germany and I was back sort of starting to just go into the gym, getting ready for preseason in a couple of weeks' time. So I had this long program kind of sorted out. Okay, I'm going to start going to the gym. And then all of a sudden I get a call up. I'm being called up for the national team. So I hadn't trained for about 3 weeks. I'd been literally partying with one of my best mates in Germany for 3 weeks. My sister was living there. I just got back to Australia and just decided to start doing some stuff in the gym. And then all of a sudden I'm on a plane heading to Edmonton to go, okay, I'm number two. I'm thinking, all right, this is fine. I'll be okay. I'll find my feet. I'll get into it. And training was fine. And remember we trained on a public park.
sounds about right in Canada, game. Yeah.
That's right.
It was like, I just remember this park and people walking around, walking their dogs and the wind as well, like you mentioned, Craig, and then thinking, right, okay, this is an unbelievable experience. I'm loving being involved and going, right, okay, this is, you know, this is a big game for us. And then all of a sudden everything happens and I come on and play this game. And that qualifier as well, like you said, we end up having to play only the third best team in South America, which happened to be Argentina. And it happened to be Diego Maradona's return after his first failed drug test. And at this stage, then Mark Bosnich came back for the first game in Sydney, which we ended up drawing 1-1. And Paul Wade played that game and he actually marked Diego Maradona out of the game, believe it or not, for literally 95 minutes of the game. There was one moment he got a bit of space, like literally half a meter space. He whipped in an unbelievable cross into Batistuta, who somehow used his telescopic neck to be able to go back away from goal and head it into the top corner, which was insane. It just shows you the level. And then, like Craig mentioned, we went to Buenos Aires. And I remember my vivid memory of Buenos Aires was actually I was on the bench for that game. Zabika was back in goal because Bozza didn't come back for it. And those were the days where there were no FIFA windows and players were missing out. And he was at Aston Villa and he was under a lot of pressure. So I remember we walked out on the pitch before the game. The minute we walked out on the stadium, because the stadium was full about an hour and a half before kickoff. And I remember standing on the pitch and we could not understand each other. And literally you're leaning over shouting in someone's ear and you could hardly hear each other. That's how loud and deafening and how intimidating that stadium was. And the fans were all throwing torn up paper and it was like it was snowing. It was incredible. And of course we lose to a kind of a really fluke goal. And we scored a goal actually, which was then ruled to be offside. So yeah, it was so close, but so far.
Yeah, but the World Cup worked out well for Maradona after that. So.
Well, yeah, I mean.
but still, you can say that you were there in the stadium, you know, on the bench and you're watching Diego Maradona. I mean, there's a presence about it, I imagine, that perhaps we haven't seen. I'm not sure even Messi has that.
No, I also think, like, you know, he was just that, he had everything, right, in terms of, obviously regarded as one of the best players to ever play the game, the skills, the authenticity, the naughtiness, the kind of getting himself into trouble. He had everything. And I think he appealed to so many different backgrounds, different walks of life. And it was difficult to dislike him, even though I lost a lot of respect for him in terms of the drug elements and that sort of behavior. But in terms of as a footballer, you know, there isn't a person around, I don't think, that could say that he was just okay. I mean, the guy was one of the best, if not the best, to live on the planet playing football. And it was pretty crazy to see what it was like when he came to Australia, the attention at the time in Australia he received. And we're talking back in 1993, where football hardly received the attention that we get today, and certainly not the recognition of the level of which it takes to get to a World Cup and what it means and everything else. And so the attention that the game received at that moment was off the charts. And then even my own teammates, how in awe and how they literally were chasing him around in the airports trying to get photos and autographs off him, which was beyond me. Like I never did. And I was like, I'm just not doing that. Like that's firstly, it's uncool. And secondly, like, yeah, it's Diego Maradona and amazing, but I'm not chasing after him for a photo or an autograph. But it was pretty surreal. And after the game, we got invited to the same nightclub that Argentina were at, and all drinks were on Diego Maradona. So yeah, that just shows the level of the kind
of guy
that he was.
And your respect came back, right, Mark?
Yeah,
they were like, I'll get a photo now.
I'm okay now with this guy.
You're okay. Yeah, you're so bad in the end.
Hockey. Before your first coffee, while the rest of the city's still hitting snooze, we're breaking down everything that happened last night.
Center, score!
The biggest moments, the key storyline, and the takes that actually matter.
Back for Kudrow, score!
Wake up and get your hockey fix. Fast, smart, and ready for your day with voices who live the game. Morning Hockey starts here. Weekday mornings on SiriusXM Morning Skate. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Click to SiriusXM.ca/Morning Skate.
And I was going to say, when you're in the stadium and the fans were throwing down those pieces of paper and it felt like it was snowing, he was right at home in that environment.
For them, it's just life, right? I don't think you've played a game of football until you've played a World Cup qualifier in South America. It is off the charts. I mean, I suppose the biggest comparison would be playing in Mexico. I can imagine playing in Mexico is a very similar thing. Like South America, having been, well, fortunate and unfortunate in some ways, but like being involved in Argentina and seeing that and experiencing that, not being on the pitch myself, but then twice being in Montevideo in Uruguay. And it's really, really difficult to explain what's at stake, the magnitude. We all know World Cup place is at stake, but for these people, it's more. And it's win at all costs, doesn't matter how you do it. The intimidation from the minute we landed in the country in Uruguay was off the charts. The abuse, the people running from whatever they were doing as we were making our way from the airport to the hotel to abuse the bus, to show their anger at us being there and trying to put us off, was something I'd never experienced in my life before. And then in the stadium, just the hostility. I said hostility in Canada, and obviously I was joking, but this was at another level altogether, and it was unbelievable. And I remember that the first time, as much as we were back in 2001, as much as we were a very experienced side and players that had played a lot of games in Europe and top level in Europe, there was intimidation. A lot of us just went, what have we just walked into? And that actually helped us for 2005. 2005, there was a vast majority of the squad that knew exactly what was being thrown at us. We knew before we arrived. There were some players that had no idea, and all of us were able to say to them, look, this is what you're going to expect. This is what's going to happen. And when they did it, we're like, yeah, that's just what they do. You know, they're a bit crazy, you know, and we dealt with the pressure so much better the second time around.
I want to bring you back. Sorry, Sharms. Wanted to say, Mark, when you were thrown in after that red card as a young man, inexperienced, you're green versus Canada, what did that experience do for you in terms of your career trajectory? Did you feel like, oh my God, thank Christ it's done? Or was it, I belong here?
I certainly didn't feel like I belonged there at that stage. I think it was still an element of trying to work out whether or not I was good enough to play that level in my own head. Like I believed in my ability to a degree, but still playing international football and World Cup qualifiers is different. It's different to playing international friendlies. It's different to playing your domestic league and playing in finals, and which I'd already done before. I'd played in the final, won the title in Australia, which was big for me then. But the international level is another step up, another five steps up. And it's because of what's at stake. The minute a game is associated with a World Cup, it takes on a completely different meaning. It is the weight of every registered footballer playing in the country, every football fan that is behind the team, and players, us, as like me growing up as a kid in Australia, I dreamt of playing in a World Cup. We'd only played at one World Cup prior to that in 1974. I was 2 years old. So obviously I knew nothing. I don't have any recollection of it, of course, but obviously I knew a lot about it and I know my history with the national team. So, and we'd had so many failed campaigns. So the minute a World Cup qualifier is there was that pressure of failed campaigns, each time. And now we just need to get over that hurdle. We need to qualify. And every game is working towards that. So the minute there's that under the umbrella of World Cup qualifier, you feel the pressure and you know what's at stake.
It's 20 years since that goal, the Uruguay game, which really, I would say it defined a class of footballers in Australia. It was such a great moment for the country. You're now in the Hall of Fame of Australian sports, let alone just football, which says everything. But by that point, you know, you'd established yourself in the 90s. You've been playing top flight football with some big clubs. The 90s Premier League, you mentioned how you shunned the attention to a certain degree compared to a lot of players, but that was the era that, I know it's the first Premier League era, but prior to that, you know, we had George Best, who was a rock and roll footballer. But these players, the Robbie Fowler, the Liverpool in the white suits, really kind of elevated this feeling of arrogance in English football. But then yourself and Craig and these guys kind of under the radar. The 90s was the best Premier League era, right?
Wasn't it? it's like, you know why? I suppose there's a lot of nostalgic towards it. And because it was the change, wasn't it? It was the change of the league and the way in which it was elevated, the TV rights, the money, the attention globally, it took it to a different level. Sky was probably the beginning of the rise of the Premier League, their involvement in the game, the broadcasting of it. So it elevated the game to a different level. And then you started to have these superstars starting to emerge. You know, David Beckham, you know, to Thierry Henry coming across, the Bergkamps, the best players in the world were starting to come to the UK and wanting to play in the Premier League. Money went through the roof. Support for games, there were waiting lists at games. You couldn't get into games unless you had tickets. So there was this real euphoria and hype around the game exploding and trying to become or going on the course to becoming the biggest and most prestigious league to play in Europe. And or if not the world. So for me, and I speak for myself, like I dreamt of playing professional football. And one of my biggest dreams was to play in the Premier League, to play, well, the English First Division as a kid growing up, but then also to play in the Premier League once that was established. Because it was the one league I thought as a kid, and also even throughout my whole life, and I still feel that today, that goalkeepers really do get respected. Goalkeepers actually get appreciated of how valuable they are. And other leagues have caught up more now. But previously, it was more like, well, we'll just put someone in there and, you know, he's useless to play an outfield, but it's not that important, put him in goal. Whereas the Premier League, I always felt that goalkeepers were equally important. Every team really knew the importance of having a really good goalkeeper, someone they could rely on. So I felt there was a really good opportunity for goalkeepers to express themselves, to establish themselves and actually get recognition. And it wasn't about being a superstar, but it was more about being appreciated for the job that you were doing. Because we all know we're different. It's all a very difficult, very specialized job. But in the past, it was always like, oh, it's a goalkeeper, just do your job. You know, what do the goalkeepers know? You can't kick the ball. He can't do this. He's in there because he's not a very good footballer. He's a failed footballer who plays in goals. So, you know, and you know, it's all the cliches and all that sort of stuff. So the English Premier League or English First Division and then the Premier League, for me, always appreciated goalkeepers, always respected them and always understood the value of a good goalkeeper.
What do you find, Mark, you know, being an Australian playing over there and the challenges of that? Because back in those days, too, the English goalkeepers were known as the best in the world. Like it was, you know, there was 10 goalkeepers you could say could easily step into the England national team. Did you find a little bit different? Because I did, certainly being a Canadian, trying to break into that and battling that as well. Did you find that there was challenges being Australian as well?
Not for me personally, because I was fortunate enough, Australians were fortunate enough, we had Mark Bosnich out there. Mark Bosnich was the pioneer of goalkeepers in England, and if not around the world. So we had outfield players and, you know, had reasonable levels of success in various different countries around Europe. But Mark Bosnich was the first Australian goalkeeper to really kind of open people's eyes up to other goalkeepers coming from Australia. And he really opened the door, and his level of performances really made people stand up and take notice. And for me, then it was from my era, players coming through, there was no surprise. And it was a kind of almost like an expectancy that what are you guys doing? You guys are always producing pretty decent goalkeepers, you know? And that's how I think for us and for me coming through to the Premier League and into England, it was a pretty straightforward one. And obviously the close association between Australia and the UK, I mean, culturally, there are obviously key differences, but there's a lot of similarities as well. The sense of humor is very similar as well. So a lot of that was pretty easy to settle into. Excuse me. It was very easy sort of to come into. And I felt that transition was quite simple. But again, you had to back it up with performances.
Do you find that as a game evolves, it's always evolving, all the positions evolve, you know, fullbacks aren't what they once were, centre-backs now carry the ball, you know, throughout the entire team, except for kind of in goal, where, yeah, you might make more short passes nowadays than you used to, but it's still very similar. Is that the one position that you could say Mark Schwarzer and Craig Forrest could still be playing in the Premier League in today's football as they were back in the 90s and early 2000s?
I think there's definitely... would be opportunities for goalkeepers like us, but the game has evolved a lot. So, but I think that the opportunities are limited now because of the way teams play. A lot of teams want to play that almost that extra outfield player playing in goal. So that you have to be exceptional with your feet. I mean, let's not forget, right? So Craig and I came through, James, at a period of time when the most significant changes in goalkeeping rules and regulations happened during our period of time of development. So we got it kind of, I think, we were kind of fortunate in some ways. It happened early enough for us to adjust. So, and the examples are, you know, the back pass rule. So the simple thing of getting the ball back in the goal, in the 8-yard box. And in the day when I was playing coming through, you used to be able to pick the ball up, put it on the ground, roll it with your hand around the 8-yard box, then pick it up again. And then it was like, and everyone could keep playing the ball back to you. You pick it up. And then it was like 4 steps. Then it was 8 seconds. And then, you know, the back pass rule came into it. So, and I was, I think, about 15 or 16 or maybe 17 or so when the actual last big change came, which was the back pass rule. And that still was enough time to adjust and to focus a lot more on being able to kick the ball out. Because prior to that, you did no work. I certainly did next to no work with the outfield players. It was just goalkeeping work. And at the end, all you do is jump in and play small-sided games. And I think from that moment onwards, there was a whole rethink of what goalkeepers need to do and how they need to practice and how they need to step up to this level and to be able to adjust to playing now with this simple rule, even a simple, seemingly simple change of rule, but it also killed a lot of goalkeepers' careers overnight, the change of the rule.
Mm-hmm. Should mention before we forget, James Johnson has a very important role here in Canadian soccer. He says hi. We had him on the show a couple weeks ago.
Wonderful.
Mentioned he'd be on the show. So he says, hi. Mark's a great guy, he says. We worked together a little bit in the past. So before I forget,
thank you.
He says hi.
Obviously, right. His role at the FA as well. So he's obviously an ex-footballer who played at lower levels, at a younger age in the national teams, and then obviously went into the business world afterwards and was back in Australia for a number of years and was very much part of that whole group of leading the federation for the Women's World Cup, Asian Cup prior to that, or not he was there after that. But so he had a big part to play and helped with the development of football in Australia.
Do you think there's some challenges in Canada that are similar to Australia and that the synergy between him and the two countries will work well for Canada?
There's definitely similarities. This goes without saying. I mean, like, you know, geographically, we're both massive countries. The populations are for our country size. We're spread out a lot. There's a geographical element. There's a competition with other sports. Huge competition with other sports, not seen as the main sport in the country. So yeah, absolutely. And of course, in a lot of ways, there's similarities in culture and personalities. Even though some would say you're probably more American than you are Australian or English, right? So, I mean, there's got to be some negatives, right?
Mark Schwartz is a dick, everybody.
You're not invited back. It's been fun, Mark.
Fuck you, man.
I feel like I'm in DC again, Wonga.
Yeah, you are.
By the way, how was that?
I was longer in DC.
Any opportunity?
It.
any opportunity Wonga has to mention he was in DC for the draw. I think actually he has two lovely daughters. The highlight of Wonga's life was being at the FIFA World Cup draw.
I tell you what, bumping into Craig and then meeting Wonga was our highlight as well, and it actually helped us survive the days in DC during a very, very interesting World Cup draw and circus.
Yeah, there's absolute legends there. I mean, everybody you could possibly think of, Baggio and Stoichkov.
I mean, do you, Craig? Do you go there? Like, because I've been to a couple of these events. First time I've been to a World Cup draw as a guest of FIFA, but I've been to a few other events for FIFA, and every time I go, I still just go, "Oh wow, oh, there's so and so, there's Ronaldinho, there's Baggio, there's whatever Christian Vieri, who I grew up with and played in Australia with, but he can't remember me, which is kind of another story altogether." but anyway, yeah. Do you feel that surreal? Do you actually just stand there sometimes and just go, "Oh wow, like this guy's like one of the best players ever to play on the planet"?
Yeah, it was insane. It was unbelievable. It really was. But out of all those guys, the one guy that most people remembered is Wonger.
Absolutely. It's true. Yeah, it's true. We actually, my wife and I were just talking about on the very last night, we're up in our restaurant area there, and our friends came up as well, and it was like, "Oh, we need to get our friends up." "Oh, Wonga, yeah, take mine." "Yeah, we're gonna—" everyone was up there, and we had a great night, and maybe we probably annoyed a few people being quite loud.
Wonga? No.
No, but I put it down to we were just having a great time and they were a bit boring.
I tend to agree, and people don't know this, but Mark, at the beginning, I'm just going to pivot a little bit, bring us back to that little review that was shown at the beginning or played at the beginning. Mark, that's Mark, how he puts himself to bed. He listens to that. He was lying when he said, I kind of knew about that. This is what he replays before bed. It's his, "I'm good enough. I'm strong enough. Yeah. I can make the next day." It's Stuart Hagg. Like,
I'm fucking Mark Schwartzer.
That's right. I can do this.
Well, sometimes I have to look at that and go, yeah, that actually was me in a previous life. Because I look at it two different ways. Like, Craig, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I look back at that. Amy, you the same, right? So you look back at that almost like a different life, a different world. Then you go, yeah, I was in that. And it feels almost like, it feels very, in some ways it feels very distant to me, but in other ways it feels very, very close. But, there's just, it's just a bit weird sometimes.
Mark,
go ahead, Moore.
No, you've kept your feet, you live in London or close to London?
Yeah, I did, just on the outskirts. Yeah, within kind of like, the greater London area, yes.
But you've kept your feet on the ground in Australia too with the Federation. Tell us about why and how you're doing it and what kind of goals it's kind of given you on your post-playing career. And, and then we can talk about your broadcast too.
It's just more recent. It's like any federation, there's elections, there's new chairman, new board of directors, there's different directions. And I've always had a pretty good relationship with the federation, throughout my whole career, which is always wonderful to have. And I think more recently, there's been a change of leadership over the last couple of years. And, Heather Garriott, who's an ex Matilda, Amy, I'm sure you're aware of Heather, and she's a legend of the women's game in Australia, she's very much involved. She was a board director at the FA, and she was very keen on getting me involved on a committee which we have. It's called the Football Development Committee. So there's three at the moment. Currently there are three either ex-players or players who are people who are involved in football in some capacity. So at the moment we have an ex sort of strength and conditioner who's been involved on and off for the national team set up for about 15 years. There's two of us as ex footballers. So one woman and one man. And so we are very much involved with any football related issues within the federation or development that the federation want to put forward. And it's run by the Football Development Committee, which also is made up with a couple of board directors. And Heather is very much at the fore of that. And what's really, really positive about it, and this is one of the reasons why it's the main reason why I actually agreed to be part of it, was that they were going to listen. The board were going to listen to it. not just as a token gesture. They are seriously going to listen to our recommendations. And I thought that was really positive, and having an ability to be involved within the national organization, the direction of the game, and also the continuing success of the women's and the men's game, because all the decisions, anything related to football is run through this football development committee. So to be part of it and having the vast experiences that I've had in football, I think it's always good to have people that have different eyes, different ears, and different types of experience, but ones that is very much the core of what you're discussing. And in the past, we probably were guilty of not having that. And so I think being part of that and having an opportunity to give back and feel that football has come such a long way, but it's also got such a long way still to go. And we have so many issues still, like everyone, and I'm sure Canada and Australia in so many ways are similar. and we're working towards trying to bridge gaps, not only from without in our own game, because we in the past we've been very, very good within our own game to kind of be to kind of be separated, not be united, not be working together as a game as a whole across the country. And there's no one reason for it, but there certainly hasn't been enough dialogue and communication and togetherness in the game. And then that then filters all the way through to government level, state and government level, which is, we have the most participated footballers, people playing football in Australia by a long way, by almost double, or I think more than double. I think it's like nearly 2 million participants of footballers in Australia across all walks of football. And when you just talk, just a quick insight into it, that when you talk about the codes, Australian rules, and then rugby league as an example, their funding per capita is more than sixfold or fivefold per person. And they have less than half of participants in the game. And I find that really difficult to stomach. We're talking about taxpayers' money. We're talking about a country that's rich in sport. We're talking about a sport that is played by any other more than I'm talking to the believers, right? But we're talking about a sport that's played by more countries. It's the most competitive and the most difficult sport to be one of the best in the world at. And we're not at the level we should be in terms of respect and funding. And so being an ex-player, having some credibility in the game. You mentioned before Australian Sport Hall of Fame. That night in 2005 was a very big reason as to why I was inducted into that Sport Hall of Fame. That is also the beginning of football being recognized and accepted and given the credibility it deserves. And that's what I want. I want football to continue to be respected and given the place in the world that it deserves in Australia. And I say in the world, but in Australia. And I want to be part of that going forward and trying to continue to push people to do that.
You could be talking about Canada.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. Everything you said there is the same here, only I think Australia is a little bit more mature as a sporting nation. You've always loved your sports. It's been a big part of the culture there. It's not quite the same here just yet. But I got to ask, growing up in England, Australia smashed England in every sport pretty much. Who was your hero? The David Campeses, the Michael Liners, Shane Warnes, Steve Waugh's. All these guys just terrified me as an Englishman. Outside of football, who was the hero for Mark Schwarzer growing up?
See, I was also a big rugby league fan. See, this is the thing, right? When I talk about going back to the football and the respect and the parity and funding, for example, I want parity. I believe in there's a place for all of us. I believe there's a place for every sport. They're very different. I'm a great example of it. I love football. It's my passion, but I also love watching rugby league, and I love watching cricket, and I'm a big supporter of the teams and my teams. And so why can't we coexist? Why can't we coexist fairly? And I believe that there is room for it. There's a place for it. What the problem is now at the moment, the balance is so lopsided, and football is the one that's suffering the most from it. So going back to your original question now is that growing up as a kid, rugby league was probably the main sport for me locally that I supported. And I supported a team called Belmain Tigers, which is now called West Tigers. So they amalgamated with another club, playing in the NRL, National Rugby League competition. And a guy growing up, one of my sort of favorite players was a guy called Wayne Pearce. So you guys probably would never have heard of him, but I was fortunate enough in September, again, was invited back and asked if I would like to be inducted into a Hall of Fame. Another one, which was 2 in 1 year, which is just madness. You're not involved in any, and all of a sudden you get 2 in 1 year. It was a stadium that we actually played the game, Stadium Australia, where we played the game against Uruguay. They actually had their inaugural Hall of Fame. And John Aloisi and I were both inducted for football. And I'm running around in circles here because this is another indicator of how far the game has come. On the night, they inducted 10 Olympians because the Olympic Games in 2000 were held at that very stadium. And then within the precedent of the Sydney the Stadium Australia precedent, was then you're eligible to be inducted into this Hall of Fame. So Ian Thorpe was one of them, a whole lot of swimmers. So there were 10 Olympians initially. They had their place on the stage, their moment, which was really nice, interviewing and so forth. Then it went on to the rugbies, so the rugby league and the rugby union codes. And then there was a third section, and they were all on stage, all very samey. And then we had the football section. So the picture is you're walking out onto Stadium Australia. There's a goal. There's a football goal in the left-hand side of the pitch, which was where the penalties were taken and where Johnny scored the winner, and I saved 2 penalties. And then Sage was at the very end of on the right-hand side at the other end. So we were then met on a different stage, and we walked down to it. And this is all during the ceremony, and we talked about the moment, interviewed. And this is what I'm trying to get at, is that football had its own place. There were 2 of us. We were the fewest number of people to be inducted from our sport, and we had our own place, and we had our own sort of 15, 20-minute segment of introducing us, talking through the moment, reminiscing, and talking about football and that moment, what it meant for football. And that's where I'm saying, like, that's where football has evolved, and that night allowed that to happen. And that's what made that very special. So Wayne Pearce was there that night. That's what I was getting at. I almost lost my train of thought there. Wayne Pearce was there that night, and I got to meet him. And that was the very first time I got to meet him.
That wasn't your point, Mark. Your point was Hall of Fame. Say Hall of Fame 8 twice. More times.
It's actually, I'm not embarrassed by it. It's not something I don't really talk about very often. I'm honored by it. I just see him as that. In particular, that for me was, it's not just, so myself and Johnny Aloisi were recognized, and it's kind of in some ways a little bit unfair because it should have been the team. It should have been the team that should have been recognized, in my opinion, because yes, we had standout moments, but it doesn't happen if for 90 minutes we don't win or 120 minutes we don't win the game 1-0. And if 3 other guys, because Mark Viduka missed, I like bringing that up, that 3 of the other guys scored their penalties. If had they have not scored their penalties, I wouldn't have had my moment. Johnny wouldn't have had his moment. So, and if I wouldn't save the penalties, Johnny wouldn't have had his moment. So all of it is intertwined. And if we're going to be the ones that are going to be accepting it, we're there representing football, and we're representing football in Australia. And that's what makes it special. And hopefully it's the beginning. That was just a long, long-winded answer, sorry. But yeah, Wayne Pearson got a chance to meet him. And then going to cricket, I probably would say I was a massive fan of the Waugh brothers. So Mark Waugh, Steve Waugh. I've met Steve Waugh a couple of times, Mark Waugh a few times as well. I met a lot of them, Adam Gilchrist, Glenn McGrath. Shane Warne, unfortunately, I never got a chance to meet, but absolute legend of the game, of course, goes without saying. Adam Gilchrist was at the Australian Hall of Fame, and I got a chance to chat with him. And, you know, it's crazy. You know, we're all big fans of everyone, and they love football. And that's the thing. Everybody loves everyone. Everyone loves their sports and respects their sports. It's just at a national level at a government level, we're not given the same as the rest.
So
that's probably us.
Your teammates were chasing after Maradona, hoping for a picture, and you wanted no part of it. Did the camera, did the phone come out to take a picture with your childhood idol?
Yes, we had a photo. Yes. Of course. Yeah. And I don't, and the thing is, I don't ask for photos from people. I don't ask. There's very few times that I actually ask for photos from anyone. There's only very, very specific people.
Like Wonger.
Absolutely.
There might be. There might
Absolutely.
Be.
But like, you know, when it comes to your sporting fans, and they say also say you should never meet your sporting idols, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of truth in that. I have to say there is a lot of truth because I've met two people that I really looked up to and I kind of wish I hadn't met them. So yeah, I'm not going to name names because it's not right. But I very, very disappointing.
I will say I've got a picture somewhere of me and Bruce Grobbelaar, speaking of legendary goalkeepers. And,
wonderful.
Bruce is great. Bruce is great.
Yes. And that's the thing though, right? It's all great, James, when they're really good people, right? Yeah. And you only know after the affair, right? And the problem is if you meet them and then go, oh, geez, that's just ruined my whole like childhood or my adulthood, even my young adulthood or my career, where you looked up to someone and you meet them and you kind of have various experiences with them and you just go, wow, no, I wish I'd never met you.
When Charlie's. Well, listen, we could keep talking for a long time, but we have to go. Thank you so much for this. Really enjoyed it. We'll have to get you on again at some point.
Love to.
There's a World Cup not just around the corner, so maybe around then.
Well, I'll be there. I'll be in Miami. I'm doing eight games for the World Cup. So I'm seven games in Miami, one game in Atlanta. So I'm working for HBS. Craig's doing the same thing. Looking forward to it. It'll be really good fun. And hopefully
you're
pleasure in Miami.
Hopefully our paths will cross at some point.
That could be dangerous.
Maybe the final. Who knows?
Who knows? But the only thing is I'm doing third and fourth playoff in Miami. And that's the only thing. So I don't know logistically, also getting a ticket. And you know how the whole FIFA thing works is a ranking thing, right? If you're not, if you're like a multiple World Cup winner, finalist and country you played for, like, I mean, we're right down the bottom, Craig.
Yeah.
Well, we got a chance.
Could be Australia and Canada in that match. You never know.
That would be amazing. But even just from access from tickets, you know, there's a whole hierarchy. You're a FIFA legend, but you're we're a FIFA legend. I think C-class ranking. I think we are, Craig. And then there's the other bands. Yeah.
A tiered FIFA. That's so FIFA.
There is. There's an unspoken tiered rank. I've been told this.
Yeah.
So you were in the same room as Roberto Baggio, but there was like a velvet.
Yeah. Or a glass partition.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's say we were in the same hotel, right? But I'm sure we're in very different rooms.
Hey, listen, you didn't miss a penalty in the World Cup final. So,
I didn't play in a World Cup final and miss one.
Mark, thanks so much, mate. Really enjoyed this.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Really appreciate it.
That is Mark Schwarzer, Australian legend, now footy prime legend, I think it's fair to say. Great, great stories. And it is amazing, the similarity. I've always thought that between Australia and Canada. Mm. And that, I mean, listen, I'm not saying that we're not a sports nation. We are a sports nation. But Australia's different level, always has been. When they created Sport Australia back in, I think, the 90s, I think it was, everything changed, like funneling money into the sports. And they got the Olympic Games in 2000. And remember Kathy Freeman and this Ian Thorpe you mentioned there. Some of these incredible athletes, right, coming out of Australia. And we've had our moments too.
Yeah, pre-red wine, Mark, and pre-red wine Wonger. We were actually talking a lot about that and about the investment. And it's not unlike the conversations we have here about, is it time that we realize in Canada that sport should be treated as infrastructure? And, you know, there's a lot of arguments for, a lot against, but I think we have to recognize the good that sport does, not just, you know, on a local level, but on a macro level, because locally it's all seen. Macro level, people are against it. And I think I'm moving more and more into the pro movement, pro sport, amateur sport as infrastructure. How about that?
And much to our, I think we took offense that Mark compared us to our neighbors to the south versus, you know, being friends with our Commonwealth country in Australia, right? He was linking that more to England. But he's talking about working for the Federation. They seem to always be in lockstep, whether it's associated with the seminal moment in sport in advance of those Olympics in Sydney, where that seems to be, that was like the great moment that everybody was called into action and worked together so that the infrastructure was up to speed, the funding for the athletes was up to speed, that there was a connection from grassroots all the way up to pro. And in Canada, we're never going to have the privatization and the investment in sport with deep pockets like the US does. So if we're going to take a step, it has to be done, to your point, Wonger, working together with the government and seeing it as an investment in your people, in your citizens, because there's absolutely a trickle-down effect when you when you prioritize athletes and the way that they're doing, not just in, you know, the push for a podium or own the podium, right? Which is like a program that brought us big success for home Olympics in Vancouver and has continued to, and then dipped recently because that funding isn't there for our athletes. But it's not just in isolation. If you treat it like that, you're doing a disservice to everybody, including the kids who are five and just want to start playing sport because it's good for them, but also because they've maybe seen their heroes on TV. It's all inextricably linked.
One more point for me is the fact that things have changed. You know, people go, oh, you used to be on this side. Well, back in the day when we grew up, we do equipment swap. It cost $100 to play, $100 to play in a league. And you were off, you shared baseball gloves. Now this professionalization at 12 years old, at 8 years old, what the F are we talking about? Mm-hmm. So things have changed. Infrastructure mm-hmm. must change with it. There's more people. It's like putting sewers in. There's more people there. You have to create infrastructure so you can grow these things out and make them scalable. So there, I don't mm-hmm. know. That's where I'm at.
Again, you travel around Australia. You have NRL, rugby league. You have rugby union. You have cricket. You have soccer now. These are incredible stadiums.
Wallaby wrestling.
Wallaby wrestling. Yep. Bingo hunting.
Jump into dingo hunting. They hunt you. A dingo ate my babies.
Oh, you've got a baby apparently.
Maybe the dingo ate your baby.
Actually, they found a Canadian girl was. They found a. A few months ago, right? And they think Bingo's got her, but then was it she drowned? I don't know the story.
Fraser Island. She went out for a jog or something.
You've been there, Wonga, Fraser Island?
Twice, yeah. It was
amazing,
fantastic.
Isn't it?
Oh, brilliant.
What a place. Yeah. God, I love Australia. I might be going back there this winter for a bit. My sister lives out there. I'm dying.
Say hi to my kids.
Oh no, you're other kids.
Right.
Yeah, sorry, I was slow on the pickup there.
I've been having dinner with some extremely loud mouthed person beside me, right. You know, like, wow, I got what a baritone on them.
And I wanted to go back to that fabulous intro that JC brought in for Mark. That was Depeche Mode, right? Playing underneath?
Yeah.
With all of the great Australian bands. Could we not have gotten an Australian tune to be underneath the highlights there?
Well, it wasn't us. In fairness, I forgot.
No, I know. We didn't produce it, but
we should get 4-4-4 Fooking 2 is the Instagram feed, I think. Let me just check this out again and confirm it.
Oh, I hear a buzzing all of a sudden.
Playing stuff and not giving credit to, because that's bullshit and it happens way too much in this business. One second here. I think it's 4 Fooking 2 is who did it.
Yeah, I think so.
4-4 Fooking 2. 4-4 as in FOUR. Fooking, FOOKING 2.
Yeah, and they should do one on Craig Forrest because that's a great little site.
They've got tons. It's great. It's really funny content. Mm-hmm. And so we appreciate 4-4 Fooking 2. And I recommend everyone give them a follow on Instagram.
And a little story about Mark and Craig and I when we were in when we were at the FIFA World Cup draw. Sorry, I have to tell the story. But Mark's wife is fantastic, Paloma. And we were all hanging out. We kind of got pushed together because of the Commonwealth conversation. And we were all sitting around and Mark and Craig knew each other. He introduced us. So Paloma and I are chatting and we're all hanging out, having a glass of wine.
Paloma and the kids.
No kids. But we're all hanging out. And this is at the World Cup thing. And I'm like, I'm trying to read the program because it tells you exactly what's going to happen, when Trump's going to arrive, when the draw is, all the jokes by Rio, the jokes by Gianni. It was like fully right there. Yeah.
But
all of a sudden, I'm trying to read and I go, where are my glasses? And Craig goes, yeah, you just had them. I go, I think Paloma stole my glasses. And so the whole thing goes around. We like the whole show goes through and we're all hanging out because the buses are late. Carney and the exactly. We literally sit through the whole thing and we end up with Paloma and Mark again. I go, Craig, I got to get my glasses back. I can't see shit. And I go, Paloma, I know this is weird, but can you check your purse to see if you have an extra pair of glasses? Because she goes, why? These are my cheap Amazon glasses. I go, yeah, they're my cheap Dollarama glasses. She had her Amazon glasses in her purse and she stole my glasses for the whole afternoon. And I had to go kind of a bended knee and not being rude, not being the normal walker, get back my glasses. Yeah.
You got my fucking glasses.
Yeah, it's literally, stop fucking stealing from me, baby.
But because you couldn't see, you tapped two other women on a shoulder and asked them prior to finding Paloma.
Are you Paloma? Nope. Yeah. Sorry. That was great. That was a fun talk.
I'm Melania.
You got to see Jesus Christ in person. So I guess you are believers now, all right? Haven't seen him at the draw. Yeah. Good for you. Hey, Dubsy, you're doing a broadcast. Is it today or tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Okay. Are you going to be obviously going on a deep dive into Canada Korea?
Into what?
Canada Korea from yesterday.
What does Canada Korea mean, though?
Korea.
Oh, Korea. My God. I'm sorry. I thought you were, I'm convinced you were saying Canada career. And I'm like, I don't know what you mean. I usually understand you perfectly.
I know you do.
Not that time.
That's refreshing, actually.
My name is Amy. Hello.
There's no career in Canada. We know that.
I'm strong enough and gosh darn, people love me.
I'm really sorry.
I apologize for my stupid accent. Trying to sound Canadian to make it easier for you.
No, God. Absolutely. It'll be a shorter one, just to fit it in to make sure that Signe and Shireen could be there. And my kids playing in hockey provincials. So I just had a short window. So we're going to do mostly women's national team tomorrow, talking about this FIFA series and like huge win, player down. Jade Rose is red carded in around, I think, the 29th minute. Controversial call.
Harsh?
No, please not get into it. But like, what a resilient, front-footed, aggressive performance from them afterwards. Playing a player down, you wouldn't have known. So South Korea were a little bit passive, didn't provide a whole lot of threat going the other way, but full credit to Canada. So they're on quite the run now where, they got the win versus Zambia, who were quite poor, but they still scored 4 goals in open play and then beat South Korea, again, a player down, 3-1. And then the big one will be the home side, Brazil, on Saturday to end or like put a bow on this FIFA series. So we'll go in depth on Canada. And then next week, we'll do our deep dive on NSL and a bit of a preview in advance of the season kicking off. Where are we today? We're Wednesday. So a week from Friday, April 24th, is NSL sophomore season kicking off.
Amazing.
Very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is great. Can't wait, actually. And I understand we might be having certain beverages being sold at certain games, JC. Is that rumor true?
Correct. You can get your red card and yellow card cocktails at your next AFC Toronto game.
Nice.
Please ask your local... Yes, millions.
I think their home opener is May 2nd, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, May the 2nd.
Well, listen, I did the math. And if AFC Toronto and Inter Toronto sell about 1 million drinks per game each, we'll get our own studio.
Mm.
So
please, I like that.
Sell a million of those drinks per game.
Oh, yeah, and really we also have Marcelo Balboa.
Yeah.
He's been on the show before. He's coming on to talk MLS and drama with the U.S. men's national team, which is.
And Inter Miami.
And Inter Miami. Oh, Inter Miami.
Oh, yeah.
Out.
Yep.
Who was Messi's boy, Messi's guy? What happened?
No longer.
Yeah. Wow. Inside track. Don't step on Messi's size sevens.
Yep. And we can also ask him about two MLS teams in Nashville and LAFC through to CONCACAF Champions semifinals.
Mm-hmm. lots to talk about. So Footy Prime has got a busy couple of days coming up. Make sure you check us out. And Footy Prime is brought to you, of course, by BetMGM. Make it legendary. We had a legend on today in Mark Schwarzer. Thoroughly enjoyable chat. We'll get some of those clips up on socials as well. In the meantime, make sure you like and subscribe to us and give us reviews and give us lots of comments. And we'll be back tomorrow. So until then, cheers very much for listening.
Footy Prime is brought to you by BetMGM. Make it legendary. Check us out on YouTube at youtube.com/footyprime and subscribe. Leave us some comments. We'd love to hear those. And check us out on Instagram at @footyprimeig and on Twitter at @footy_prime. And check out wearefootyprime.com. Sign up for our newsletter.
You're a real pro.
I totally am.
You and your Canada career.
With my crazy accent.
Your podcast career.
Well.
Hey, how you going? My name's Jan. I never knew my father.
Good get, Craig. Mark was terrific.
That was great.
No Wonger sorted that out.